Livestock is different.
Livestock is different, although it's not usually considered different, but...
As far as loan limits are concerned.
As far as the loan limits are concerned, I'm just wondering if maybe we could make a change in that, in the chattel section, to have two separate chattels, you might call it. One is cattle, or animals, and the other is machinery. And raise the limit, and put the limit in for the $300,000 on each one of them. Would that help? I mean, that's just, I'm brainstorming now, is what I'm saying.
Sure, but, you know, maybe like Lisa mentioned, is why not leave it up to the reasonable discretion of your banker?
Yeah, I was just going to say, Pappy, we haven't heard any testimony here yet that suggested there should be a limit. It should be up to what was prudent for the operation that was being considered.
Would you like the point of view supporting the need for a limit?
Yeah. Yeah, looks like we need one.
As an economist, I probably look at things a little bit differently than a farmer does, but I think that given the figures that Lee had suggested earlier, and adding to that investment in land, I think even the largest farm in the Delta area is looking at a total investment of somewhere near $1.25 to $1.5 million. And I think that if you start to break that up, I think a little bit of that should be owner equity. I don't think that it should be fully state financed 100%. I think each individual needs to make an investment. But more importantly than that, I think that the important use of ag revolving loan fund capital should be for the development of agriculture, not for necessarily the sustaining of whatever one might be interested in sustaining. So what I'm suggesting is I think there is a need for an upper limit in that I think you want to be capable of financing the developing operation, but I think that there has to come a time when the developed operation looks to commercial credit sources. I think that's the important need for an upper limit. For example, if you had two tracks on a Delta project that someone was considering merging the two of them to become a 6,000-acre farm, I'm not at all sure that you want to support that with state financing. I think that it then has to be looked at on strictly its economic merit, and if you're looking at it strictly on its economic merit, it should look toward commercial financing. So I think that you need to gear that upper limit to be sure that it will accommodate the developmental aspects of agriculture in Alaska, the project types of involvements here in Alaska, but not leave it open-ended as a program to be mined at the whim of someone who is, for example, using it as a tool to speculate on land by acquiring large, vast amounts of land.
Would you comment then on maybe a time factor that you would consider a particular area for a developmental loan?
Well, I don't think that it's necessarily a time factor. I think it depends on the stage of a particular operation. I think that all of the Delta Project farms are developmental in nature. 10 years down the road, they may not be, but Nenana may still well be developmental. I think that you have to, I think that the state has a responsibility to assure that financing is available for farms to develop. At some point in time, we're going to have a developed agriculture, and I think that developed agriculture then needs to look to commercial sources of credit. I think that limit needs to be set, though, so that it surely does not impinge on the efforts of individuals like these two who are trying to develop a farm operation. To go a little bit further, the term chattel mortgage has come up. I, as an economist, divide things up a little bit differently. I look at real estate, I look at land investment, capital investment, and operating capital. And that chattel falls kind of over two of those. Part of it includes chattel mortgages. I'm looking at capital as being the building, which is not a chattel mortgage, but also being the cattle, which is a chattel mortgage. But I think there's some important distinctions between types of loans. I've never seen anywhere where a person, with the exception of the state of Alaska, where a person could borrow money at the same rate for an unsecured operating capital loan as he can for a real estate investment loan. And I think that you have to look a little bit at the type of loan you're administering when you start talking about what interest rates should be, and also when you start talking about loan limits. If you move up into the categories of the more secure loans, the real estate loans and the capital loans or chattel type loans, they are secured loans. And I think that you need to take that group of loans and establish a limit on them possibly, and maybe take the operating capital loan, which is a totally different type of loan, and establish a limit there rather than dividing things up like Lee was suggesting. A chattel loan having a certain limit on it, I don't see the sense in that. If, as an example, say that you have someone who wants to go into commercial hog operation. 80% of his loan is going to be a chattel-type loan. He's going to be looking at substantial investment in livestock. He's not making that big land investment. He's making a big capital investment, and he shouldn't be hindered in doing that because of the limit on a specific type of loan. I think the only relevant distinction is operating capital and secured loans. I don't think there's any need to distinguish between cattle and livestock or along the lines of that. So I guess essentially I'm saying I think that the credit system needs to be given a serious look at to establish some upper limits that will accommodate all developmental efforts but would preclude any, for the lack of a better term, any mining of the program. And I think that that some clearer distinctions need to be made between operating capital loans and capital secured loans. And to carry that a step further, I think that there needs to be an explicit distinction made between loans for a farm operator versus a loan for farm support businesses. I can see very well with the co-op where $2 million loan limit would absolutely preclude the development that they have been charged with having to undertake. So that's a farm support business. I see much less reason for a limit on loans, or if there is to be a limit, it needs to be substantially larger than anything available today.
I'm just sitting here listening to him. I'm just wondering if you would be prepared to present in written form your recommendations along these lines to this committee. I think that report or that recommendation would be of value to us in these other loan programs also, because I see the same parallel that we're looking at in this ad hoc committee, you might call it, along the same lines. And I would like to ask you, if you would, to present us your own recommendations along these lines, basically for the agriculture end of it, what agribusiness we're interested in. I think maybe that would give us time to kind of cogitate over what you're saying here.
I'd be glad to. I'd have to ask what the time constraint would be on that, though.
We always want these things yesterday.
Could you have them in the morning by 8 o'clock? I hope that you can do it, because I think you've got some very good points here. They make a lot of sense.
I sometimes
find myself carried away with my enthusiasm to carry the ag business on further, and I get myself out in left field quite often and contract hoof and mouth disease. My foot gets in my mouth quite often, and it sounds reasonable what you're saying, and I would appreciate it very much if you would.
Okay, well, the reason I asked about time constraints particularly is I think it would be difficult to get them to you before Friday night.
Well, no.
And I'm going to be leaving for Candle, Alaska, and I'm not sure there's a post office there that
you're
can mail
to Candle, Alaska?
You're going to Candle?
Yeah.
What the hell are you going to do up there? You're in the mining business now?
I play with the
be careful.
A little bit.
Oh, you do? Oh.
The last time we were up there, they had started to improve the airport, and they found gold on the end of it, and they quit building the airport.
Started mining gold,
by God.
If a one-week time constraint would be...
That, I think it's really an important issue, and it would be...
Should I address that to you then?
Address it to the Special Ag Committee.
Okay.
Pat Carney would be all right. He's chairman of it, and I'm sure that we'd like to look at it in writing, I think. What do you think, Rob? We might even be able to use that as a guideline for some of this other loan things. Because actually, I think all these loan programs, in a sense, that we're looking at, your fish and all the other stuff, kind of have the same guideline. Well, even the mining deal, when you think
about
it.
Who are you going to stay with up there?
We've got special accommodations for the workshop. There are 50 people going to be there.
Oh, is that right?
We're going to take Jack with you. Go up and see what the hell they're doing if you don't know about 50 people.
Well, I just passed a bill today to make reindeer a domestic animal.
I thought they already were. I didn't
know. No, there was no classification for them. Yeah, well, we're classified bison and musk oxen. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Kelly, you got some comments you'd like to make?
Well, I feel like maybe I'm being a little bit ignorant, but it was my understanding that the problem that other financiers had with particularly the Delta project, but I could see probably Point McKenzie as well, is that the farmers lacked collateral for anyone else interested in probably financing it, and so they did have to ask for such large volumes of money from the Ag Revolving Loan Fund because they don't even own the ag interest in their land.
I might comment, though. I think what he's saying,
wrong,
though,
huh?
Correct me if
That's
I'm wrong,
I understand.
You've actually got you got two things you're talking about. You're talking about developmental and operational later.
Mm-hmm.
You develop for a period of time, and then once you drop out of that category, you're into the business then, so to speak, and it changes the picture to some degree.
You mentioned three.
Haven't they done that?
Well, I look at it as
they go outside for
I look at three different types of loans, but I look at two different types of situations.
Sure,
and maybe there's no one in the second situation in Alaska today, that being a fully developed and functional farming operation. But I think that it's important as we look at agricultural development to remember that we don't want to create an industry that is indefinitely dependent on state funding. We want to create a self-evolved system, a self-maintaining system that is not dependent on states, continually dependent on state support. And I think that there are going to be farmers within 4 or 5 years who might well reach that level where they're a fully functional unit and would look at the money available from the state as a unique opportunity to build an empire, if you will.
Well, I'd like to make a comment. Excuse me, Bob. I think you should also address Mike and Eric at such point, at one point in time, when the development stage is done, we do have the marketing structure working. The farmer should be able to buy higher interest money. I don't think we should just marry to the 6% money.
Right.
That bothers me because you're going to look for for conventional money. I think the state should be the lender of the money, or could be, but at the interest rate compatible to what it is someplace else. It should not preclude the state from not being the lender, but at least get the interest at the same fee you buy from somebody else.
Well, if we were to look down the line, what I would perceive would be something along the line of the state taking on a very long-term commitment to the financing of land. That their commitment to the financing of capital improvement would be weaned off a bit earlier. And that operating capital loans might well be something that farmers would be faced to going to commercial sources for within 2, 3, or 4 years. Because operating capital loans traditionally in an evolved agricultural area will be high interest. I mean, farmers in the Pacific Northwest pay 15% for operating capital money, and they pay that because it's money they can pay back in 2 or 3 months, rather than having to have 10% money tied up for a full year. They'll take 15% money for 3 months as an operating capital loan. And I think that we need to slowly start doing that so that we're not tying up state funds that could be used for fundamental development in operating capital. We should start drawing from commercial sources for that operating capital so that state funds can go further as a source of developmental funding for land purchase, capital improvements, et cetera.
Comes back to your bill, Bob. Give the man some fee simple land so he can use it for collateral.
I'm drawing up a bill to make that land turn.
Trying to settle here on item 4. What is the consensus of the committee here as to removing the limit on the individual loans applied for in the Agricultural Revolving Loan Fund? Do we go on And with that bill at present, or do we put a sort of a time restraint on us till 2 weeks, or?
We give notice that we're going to file one so that we can still get in the door. And then when these special hearings are over with, we decide whether we need to file it or whether we don't.
Okay. Agreed. So be it. Item five.
This was at the request of the revolving loan fund officer and his staff.
Item four.
Number five.
Oh, okay. Item five, need bill to amend the agricultural revolving loan fund statutes to change penalty clause from 15 days to 30 days to date of receiving, and to change the interest rate from 7% to 5%. Kelly?
The rationale behind that is, first I'll take the interest percentage, and they say that the VA loans are going for 5%, and
well,
the...
No.
I'm just repeating what I heard.
That's what hit me there.
Where did you hear
that? 7.5.
Yeah, in Doug Jacobson's office. And as testified last year, they brought up that the Ag Revolving Loan Fund has the best track record of any revolving loan fund in the state for payback and loss on their money. And therefore, they thought that since they do return such a sizable percentage of the money that they lend out in to the state with interest, that there should be a preferential treatment of their interest rates. And then the other aspect, at the present time, the policy has been that a farmer gets his extra charges starting from 15 days after his mailing date. And they have had considerable problems with this, particularly when the mail is coming in the middle of the winter across Alaska. And therefore, they consider that it would be administratively more practical if the late charges began 30 days from their date of receipt.
I have no objection to the 30 days, but I do think we have a problem with that 7% to 5%.
I think you do.
I think you got a hell of a problem, Happy.
Don't count on anything under 7.5 and probably under 8.5.
Yeah.
So tell them they're lucky to get 7.
Yeah, they got 7. Tell them
so I would, I'd propose to you guys that we do ask for the change from the 15 days to the 30 days. Any objection?
I think that's valid.
Any comments, Lee?
Mr. Chairman, are you not is this not referring to the penalty clause only that's attached to this bill and not the flat interest rate that you're being charged?
I think that's correct.
Just a flat penalty.
You know, it's a penalty charge, percent charge on
if I'm late on a payment, it's going to be reassessed at 7% as it is now.
Yeah.
We addressed that last year in here, didn't we?
Yeah. We talked about it.
In resources.
Bob, you got any comment on that? Okay, that's where we'll go. We'll make the amendment on the let me ask one question. Are we on good ground with a 30-day deal now? Is that reasonable?
The only reason for the bill is because you had a problem from outlying areas. Is that right?
Yeah.
That's what they said.
And I couldn't decode this from the 7% to 5%. I couldn't figure out. We looked at it this afternoon. Why you would reduce the rate of interest because you were late in paying the bill? If you're already paying 6%, then if you were late in paying it, you go down to 5%.
Actually, Lee, what I think it is, like Jack said, we discussed this, and the way it is now, it's on the amount that you're past due on, et cetera.
Right.
That's what it is.
Oh,
it's not on your whole smear. Okay. So we'll only recommend a change on the days. Well, Bob, I guess that puts it up to you, Mr. Pollock. We're supposed to have a report from Mr. Pollock. Here's item six.
But if you could tell me what you wanted me to report on.
I'd like to hear some talk about the Delta project.
Well,
I'll tell you, one reason I'd like to hear something, if you got anything in writing, I'd sure like to have it, because we've got a thing coming up the 28th. Are you going to be down here the 28th?
I can't say from one day to the next now where I'm going to be at. You know, I could be just about anywhere. I didn't find out. You know, I didn't know exactly that you wanted a report. I'm happy to answer questions. I can bring you up to date where we're at right now.
I'd just like to know how we stand on the project now myself, because it is the major project at present in the state and the key to a lot of other projects that will be coming in the future.
Well, I think we're at a point in time in the Delta Project where a lot of people are finally coming to grips with how technical and how complex agriculture is. I don't think a lot of people, farmers, university people, bureaucrats included, realized just exactly what they were getting into a year ago. We really haven't seen very much change in the progress of the clearing on the Delta Project since last fall. Over the winter time, it's, you know, the dark, the cold, the snowpack, we really haven't seen very much activity out there. We're to the point right now, we're kind of in a transitional phase where we've got a lot of people out there who we've called farmers who in fact have just been land clearers, and they're getting to the point where they're trying to decide what phase of agriculture they're going to go into. A lot of people, the tract owners out there, haven't decided yet whether they're going to go into grain production, whether they're going to go into hog production, whether they're going to go into cattle. They really don't know. We're to a point now where we're processing is a vital link. This agricultural development is a whole chain of events, and that we've been just working on one or two links. We've worked on clearing the land. We've worked on making loan monies available for machinery purchase. But processing is one link where we haven't worked on yet. Transportation is one link that we haven't worked on yet. And we're just getting to the point now where we've got to start working on those. The sad part about it is that these links that we've left out may in fact be very expensive links. And that if we don't put those links together for the whole chain, everything that we've done before may fall apart. In the area of, you know, marketing, transportation, processing, our farmers up there in Delta Junction are a little bit perplexed what to do right now. The state has asked them to go out and start producing grain or start producing livestock, but it's a catch-22 situation. It's kind of useless for them to start producing livestock without knowing where they're going to go with it or where they're going to process it. But at the same time, we've got the situation where we don't know whether we should actually build a processing plant because we can't justify it because there aren't enough animals to go through it. I don't know, if you could give me a little bit more time, I could have given you a little better presentation. But I'm open to answer questions. The project's still alive and well. In fact, it's going better than ever.
You've got a study that tells you what the minimum daily livestock slaughter would have to be to support a plant, don't you?
No, we don't.
I thought you did. Somebody told me the other day that you did.
I've never seen a study yet that has shown us the minimum number of animals.
I think that's being worked on now by the Pork Task Force that's contracted to the Agricultural Action Council.
Well, I talked to Connie Bodine, who is the head of that task force, and they are waiting right now for some input from the Agricultural Action Council as to what they're supposed to actually come up with.
Well, in talking with that group, the impression that I had was that there isn't that magic number that we can ever hope for. It's a matter of what kind of margins are available between the production costs for livestock within Alaska and the market price of products. Depending what kind of a margin there appears to be available there, that will determine how efficient a plant you have. If the margins are very slim, you need a very large plant. If they're not too slim, then possibly a technology that was being used in lower 48 50 years ago, or 30 years ago, might be very appropriate here. I think this group will be able to sort of bracket the kind of thing that we're we're going to face in the state?
They've asked us, you know, if, from my standpoint, this task force, the Agricultural Action Council has funded, is trying to put together the whole package, the processing package for us. And they've asked us for some questions that we're going to have to go back to the farmers with, because they've told us that before they can actually come up with any scale or size or processing facility, they need to know how many animals we're looking at. Because if we're only looking at 5,000 animals next year and then 10,000, 15, they're going to develop a different plant than if we had twice that many. They've said that, you know, whatever the number of animals we're going to have with, there is some sort of a plant that they can come up with.
I think the key here is producer commitment. That's one of their big points. And the same, along with this, what Mike suggests is margin. And once these are known, you can figure out the size of plant. What they're saying is that a plant that puts out, say, 100 head a week could be a workable unit. But it could be a non-workable unit if they relied on producer commitment at 100 a week. And then down the line didn't get it. And this is true of all facilities. It's not so much economies of size in this particular aspect.
Bob, somewhere I read a report that they're looking maybe by 85, I think it is, that about half of your crop there will be rapeseed and the other half will be barley, for example. How accurate is that report?
Well, I don't know. I sure wouldn't want to take claim to a report like that. I don't think that even Lee as a farmer can tell you.
No, commenting about that aspect right now, you know, this will be my second year on the place, and right now I'm ironing out my own bugs and the physical aspects of actually farming, you know, running the tractor here, fertilizing there, and so on. And right now my attitude is to stick with one crop and become efficient with that and become familiar with my machinery and the farm location and the various plots that I'm farming before I go in and decide I'm going to flip rapier and something else over here, plus my cattle over here. Limit myself to one thing that I can do a good job on right now, and so forth. I very much intend to look into rape in the future. It's a very viable crop in my mind. Right now, I'll stick to barley this year.
Well, Bob, then I'll ask you the question, then. Do you have any idea? The reason I'm asking the question about rape is because we're looking at the possibility of an oil mill. Is it feasible with the acreage that we have in the Delta area? Or would it be more feasible in the Nenana area?
It wouldn't be feasible at all.
Right. I can just tell you what the Canadians have told us. And that's the closest we've come. Is they tell us that they need 600,000 acres in rape production before they can afford an oilseed processing plant. But some of the other areas that we need to look into that we haven't is, I think rape has a tremendous potential as a protein supplement here on a lot smaller scale. The Canadians are doing a lot of research with using whole rapeseed in ingredients for feeding. Something like that.
Cattle feed.
Sheep, hogs, or whatever. We need a lot more research in using rapeseed in that area. It may be possible for us just to export the raw rapeseed without converting it to oil.
What would be your market there?
You've got the entire Pacific Rim country. I've had inquiries from Europe, Saudi Arabia, just everywhere. It's an oil seed crop. So that in itself, the high protein, is going to lend itself to anybody that's got money. But what I'm trying to say is that, you know, there's a lot of areas that we don't have the answers for yet. But we shouldn't expect to have the answers for it. We've only been essentially in agricultural production for a year. The university has got so much that they could do as far as research yet, into rapeseed, into other crops too. We can say beyond a shadow of doubt we think that there's potential there. But I hesitate to say that rapeseed is going to be the crop of the future, or that barley is going to be the crop. I think that your farmers are going to go to any area that's going to make them money if you give them the chance.
Carol, do you have a comment on that?
Well, I'd like to comment a bit on the 600,000 acres in rapeseed. Keep in mind that rapeseed is traditionally grown in Canada on a one-third rotation. In other words, it's only grown every third year, and that's a maximum. They suggest in some cases growing 4 or 5 year rotation. So in order to get 600,000 acres of rape into production, it's going to require 1.8 million to 3 million acres, and we don't have it.
Not for a day or two.
Not for a day or two. So I think a rapeseed processing facility is right now completely out of the picture. Bob is quite right. If we do grow rapeseed, we're going to need to use part of it as an animal feed supplement, protein supplement, because some of it isn't going to make grape.
Right. What is our potential for export on rape without processing or what have
you? Oh, it's high. It's very high.
I think it's better than your potential for exporting the oil product because
yes.
Japan wants the seed so they can run it through their processing plant. They do not want the oil.
Yeah.
And our comparative advantage in marketing on a world scale is the fact that we are close to Japan. So looking at them, I think it would almost be foolishness to consider the processing plant even if you had the acreage to warrant it.
Okay, then my thinking has been right then when I say that we've talked about exporting barley. But that barley should be put in four-legged critters and the rapeseed exported. Is that what we're saying?
Well,
yeah. Okay, I think that this has been a problem of the state is that, you know, when you're just starting something like this, you start grabbing for straws and you've got a problem. You'll say, first of all, that export is the answer. And you put all your efforts on export. And then somebody will get the bright idea, no, we got to put it through four-legged animals, and then you put all your effort there. I really think that in agriculture, in any kind of marketing, you got to look at all of your alternatives. Livestock probably, for the long run, is the most politically saleable. It's the best for Alaska. You can upgrade your product. But realistically speaking, it's going to be impossible for us to develop an agricultural system based just on livestock. Next year, we're going to have 10,000 plus tons of barley on the project. Following year, we could have 20, 25,000 tons. Livestock is very important for marketing, but it's impossible for livestock to come on fast enough to utilize all that. I want to get back a little bit. We're talking about rape, and the same pertains for barley. We are located in a part of the world where if we can refine our transportation system, we can take advantage of our location rather than being a disadvantage. We've identified it may be possible for us to get barley or rapeseed from Delta Junction to the coast for $20 to $25 a ton. Well, that's as cheap or slightly cheaper than it costs Montana farmers to get it from Montana to Portland or Seattle. When you can do that, we can export as efficiently as anybody else. Now the reason we're not exporting right now, this 1,000 tons, is because 1,000 tons isn't economical. I don't want to fall into the danger of saying that, well, we need 10,000 tons to export economical, because 10,000 tons won't be economical either. It'll be better than 1,000. But, 100,000 will be a lot more economical than 10,000. But we need to look at both export and livestock.
What's the best figure you've got now on getting a ton of grain to Tidewater?
To Tidewater right now? The expensive part isn't getting it to Tidewater. The expensive part is getting it from Tidewater on a ship. That's expensive part. The railroad is quoted as a rate of $13 a ton. Now, if we can get them to hold that, that's from Eielson to Whittier Seward. And that's a very competitive rate.
And you're talking about handling facilities somewhere.
Right. We need to look at handling facilities both at Eielson and at the coast. Or, as you said, extend your railroad down there. That's why I say the transportation system. If we can refine that so that we can get it to the coast and onto a ship as cheap as anybody else, then we're going to be competitive.
Now you're getting to the area that I specifically invited you to attend, I think. I was informed by the Kodiak cattlemen that they are presently using about 2,000 tons of grain a year. If they had the storage, et cetera, they would be happy to use it. And Bruce Willard down at Homer said that that area uses about 1,000 tons a year. Currently, those are current. Of course, that's saying a bad winter, which is this year they're having a comparatively bad winter. And so I understand that one of you is going to be able to tell us how much a loading and unloading tidewater facility would cost.
Well, I can tell you what the state's consultant has told us, approximately what it would cost.
Who's that?
The state hired Sterling Haskins Construction Company out of Spokane, Washington, to put together a preliminary feasibility study of an export facility.
And will that be available, Bob?
It's available right now.
Could we get copies of it to the committee?
Sure.
I appreciate it if you try to see if we can't get copies of it. We'd like to look at some figures.
They've given us the figures just for information that here in Alaska, that facility would probably cost. Now, you've got to understand this. They haven't put the exact. They'll tell us what it'll cost in Spokane, Washington. And there's a big change to that in Alaska. But up here, it's going to cost approximately $3.6 to $5 million.
Great. What size facility are you talking about?
I believe that was approximately an 800,000 bushel facility.
Okay. One other question I got then. At Kodiak, for example, Kelly just said 2,000 tons. One of the things they've been doing at Kodiak, most of their grain has been coming in bags. We have no handling facilities, but we don't need that size of facility at Kodiak. We also need facilities out on the Aleutian Chain for this grain. We need some smaller facilities, for example, at Kodiak and Homer and out on the chain, plus the fact that if we get something going downriver, we might need some smaller facilities there.
Well, I think, I don't know about these figures, but I don't think the figures are really important of what they're using out here. I think the key is that the agriculture should be a statewide approach, and that we've got little pockets of agriculture all over the state, and there's one thing missing, is they're not connected with a sufficient or economical transportation system. Like I said, these Kodiak and Homer people are getting their grain now out of the lower 48. Because it's cheaper for them to get it out of Seattle than it is out of Delta Junction. It
costs them $300 a ton.
On the same scale, farmers in eastern Washington get their urea cheaper than farmers in Delta Junction, and it comes out of the exact same plant.
Okay, you're beating on one of the things that on transportation, and this is kind of leading around to something I'd like to toss out. We need to continue for a period of time a sort of a subsidizing system on transportation in order for us to compete. These are some of the figures that we've got to look at for a period of time until we can get our transportation system in better shape. Mike, I don't know what your comments would be on that, but we're generating a new agribusiness. We've got to subsidize something in the form of transportation, as I see it, and some of these facilities that we need right now for a period of time. We have certain things there at the Delta area that we need to continue. The marketing, for example, we've still got work to do on that. Could you hazard a guess, Bob, when we could expect the state could get out of the subsidy business? If we get this thing on the main line.
I'll tell you what, I really wouldn't want to speculate on that, just from the standpoint that if the federal government were to get out of agriculture 100% in the lower 48 today, the whole thing could fall apart. In other words, it'd be a complete, it wouldn't fall apart, but you'd see a complete change in the agricultural system. I don't necessarily think there's Well, in a way, they are subsidizing agriculture, but they're more supporting it for the benefit of everybody. Because the federal government has seen fit to support or subsidize agriculture, the American people have got the lowest cost of food anywhere in the world. Because they've seen fit to support agriculture, they've got the most efficient agricultural system in the world. You know, they produce more grain per acre than any other acre in the world. Every American farmer right now is producing for 63 people. And something in excess of 20 of those people are not even in the United States. But I wouldn't want to speculate.
Okay, when the then states I guess what I'm saying is that one of the things we've got to consider here, the state has to consider, we've got to subsidize for a while yet in certain areas. Now, we talked about this farm business here. When it becomes a producing farm, we go to the commercial markets for monies and so forth. But it looks like then our transportation and other items, we're going to have to continue to subsidize those for a period of time. This is what I'm trying to say.
Okay. Now, I can buy that. Now, I see the state's role, and in fact, it is a subsidization, because if the state gets in and builds the processing facilities, puts together the transportation network, essentially, it makes farmers competitive with agriculture in the outside. In a way, that is a subsidization, but that's probably an indirect means, if you say indirect. But one thing we're really missing the boat on up here is tying our agricultural system into the national agricultural system. There are so many programs that the federal government offers in assistance that we should be taking advantage of that we're not.
Are there any studies going on in that field there? Because I was just going to ask you that question. What are we doing about getting some help from the federal government? I think that the very fact that we put out millions of dollars already of state dollars supporting the new agribusiness, are we missing the boat somewhere on federal funds of some sort?
I think we're missing the boat in a big way. I was back in Washington, D.C. about 3 weeks ago, and that one trip, we found out that there's quite a few programs that we already qualify for here in the state that we didn't even know about. For example, loan money to build storage facilities.
Commodity credit.
Commodity credit. At the present time, we do qualify for those programs. Now, in a week, we may not qualify because it gets awful technical.
But it's 10.5%, and right now people can get it for what? From the revolving loan fund.
Right.
It's the argument I've been getting this week because I've been...
That's a danger. We're using the revolving loan fund as a crutch. And that, you know, if I were a farmer, I sure wouldn't want to get 10.5% if I could get 6%.
Full row paying interest.
But we're... through Senator Stevens' office, we're trying to initiate a study of all federal agricultural programs and outline each one of them and find out whether Alaska qualifies. If they do, how we can get into the program. If they don't qualify, what we have to do to qualify.
Carol, I might ask you a question. I've been sitting here thinking about this. Does a university do any sort of study work that would maybe get these ideas? I don't know who would do this. Maybe we need to do it within the state itself. Find out where all this money could be available. Could maybe we fund a study through the university? Because you've got a lot of handles on a lot of things there to see. You know, we have a lot of so-called grant writers in all the villages and all the school districts always trying to figure out angles. The school people are pretty damn sharp on it. And they can figure out grants, and I think the university has done a beautiful job over the past years. I'm just wondering if maybe the university could conduct a study as to where we can get money from the federal sources.
They can. Like Bob said, give money to study anything. We do have one person on our faculty, Dr. Bill Workman, who has done work along this line. The way he generally attacks the problem of that type, though, would be to look at the federal source and then consider the impact of using it in the state. Mike, do you know of anybody?
Not really. And I think one of the problems that you run into there is that most of the federal programs for agriculture are changing at a sufficiently rapid rate that any study that was done would be out of date by the time it was finished.
I think the best bet would be to continue along with Karen Perdue at Senator Stevens' office and keep the information as current as possible.
Well, how about Don Young's office, too?
Let's
put the cat on all three of them's back.
Sure.
Let me ask you a question, Mr. Chairman. We already have an office set up in the state. We said it. ASCS money, basically speaking, under that program.
Yes.
You already have offices here. Why is that not the information not put out by those people? If there's money available,
this is what I'm asking.
Federal programs.
And in fact, the money I was told is unlimited. They said there would be more money available for this state than we would have people applying.
Bob, would that be possible?
Who knows about it, though?
We're taking that up today because I've been pretty critical of our ASCS people, and I talked to them today, and we've set up a meeting for next Friday to look into these. One program that they didn't even realize was available is cost-sharing programs.
Right.
They've just established a 3-year cost-sharing program for minimum tillage. It's usually they're 1-year programs, but this is a new 3-year program. And the head of our ASCS didn't even know about it here.
Okay,
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to mention it. It really, all it takes, I think, would be just one person putting in about a week's amount of time, because last year, that's what I put in. I simply went through the federal code over there in the law library, and I copied out anything that seemed to apply, any program, and they're on file, as a matter of fact.
Well, I think down here about item 8, we might have Oh, we got the range lab. Did we have the bill in here about an agriculture department? Maybe we're going to...
There's a pile of them right there.
Okay. We might discuss that. I know we're kind of running long here, but I'm real interested. I hope the rest of you are as interested as I am in the conversation we've had. Lee?
I'd like to make a comment based on what Bob said in reference to what a processing system would entail and what we need to get it fired off, whatever happens to be. I don't think we can wait for 3 years down the road to put up a meat processing plant. If you intend to use that to develop the Delta Agricultural Project, because one, you're going to have to move the commodity through the system. Bob is right, transportation is very high. If railroad doesn't fly, it isn't going to fly for 5 years. If it doesn't start flying tomorrow, it'll be several years. There has to be a conversion factor. Carroll says, yes, the size of the plant has not been defined. Very true. Mr. Boudin will not define the size of the plant until such time as he can get a commitment or get somebody to commit it from people. People are not going to commit unless there's a known fact. A known fact being there is a system there because they've gambled all their life already. You've got to start to face reality. When somebody says we're going to put up a plant, whatever size it may be, we will handle that commodity. We have to find a market for that. The market is here locally, according to Mr. Alvin Dane. Right? He said it's here. Just go get it. You aren't going to be in competition for 5 to 10 years if you started yesterday because of the fact you can't raise enough. We know what the amount of consumption is in the state, both on beef and pork. Maybe what we have to do is an interim measure to put up a plant large enough at this time or generate the existing facilities which are in the state. That's already here. On a positive, meaning if you went to Don McKee and you went to Pioneer Packers, and I even said this, if you dreamt about revitalizing starting to buy, I know I can hang 25 hogs a day in my cooler, in my plant, that I can take care of hogs. I've done that in the past. Put another line in there. Then we need a system for processing, meaning rendering, etc. All we need is to put up another building. Whatever it would take to put it up. Not a big expensive dollar at this time. At least you can. Whatever it was, 10, 15 head of beef a day, 25 head of pork, whatever. We have an interim type thing. It's low dollar cost. And then you have a positive cut. Now the farmer begins to produce 20. You begin to raise your grain.
Bob? Well, I was just going to say that we're not going to have any black and white figures of what it's going to take for a processing plant or an export facility or whatever, that you're going to be able to say, you know, we would like to appropriate X number of dollars for this facility. But one approach you may want to consider is appropriating a sum of money, $10 million, $50 million, into the revolving loan fund, but earmarking it specifically for agricultural processing facilities. That means that if a group of farmers in Palmer should come up and say that, and they've got a good economical feasibility study for a vegetable processing plant, it can go that direction. It can go into the direction of a meat processor. It can go into the direction of a transfer facility. But at least you've got the mechanism there for the financing. And then you're going to essentially leave it to private enterprise to come up with the good feasibility study to be able to borrow that money.
Something that concerns me when we get on the topic of livestock in the state of Alaska, that's a very nice way to market grain in that you do add value to it. But I become very concerned when I hear it almost sounding as though it's an alternative to export marketing. And my concern is this: without export marketing, without that potential, I think that you face three potential scenarios. The first would be, export marketing would be the first scenario. The other, if you don't export market, I think you face one of two situations. As has been the case in the past, the value of barley in the state was determined as Seattle price plus freight. That value was too high a value to feed it through livestock and put it in the counter as meat. Now, if you don't have an export marketing facility, a word that economists use that comes into play is the elasticity, the price elasticity. And what I'm talking about is with agricultural products, if you've got just a little bit more than you need, the price plummets rapidly. If you've got just a little bit less than you need, the price rises extremely rapidly. Very sensitive. It's characteristic of agricultural markets. And so without an export facility that you can tie into the world market to determine the value of that product, then without it, you're going to continue to face problems in marketing in the state, because you're going to continually face just this situation. If you've produced just slightly more barley than what you need and can market through your livestock, the bottom will fall out of the market and the price will drop down to $30, $40, $50 a ton, even though you've just got a little more than you need because of the competition to sell. And then on the other side of the coin, you come up with just a little bit less than what's demanded for this livestock industry, and the competition is there wanting that product, that agricultural product. All of a sudden the price jumps $130, $140, $150, $160. All of a sudden you can't afford to feed it through your livestock and your industry declines. Now you get that happening as a result of the barley market not tying into world market prices. And at the same time, if you allow that to happen, then you're going to go back into the same thing that you've had in I don't know how many agricultural examples here. You get a lot of production one year and it drops clear down the other year and it swings back and forth and everything is so radical that elements start dropping off and you're back to having nothing. Now that scares me to death when I hear it talked about as livestock being an alternative marketing scenario. I don't think it's an alternative at all. In my mind as an economist, I think that one of the critical elements of our agricultural development is to be able to put that commodity into the world market so that that marginal amount, when we don't have quite as much demand as there is product, that we can get it out of here. I think you have to tie into that base in order to attain stability in your industry.
Mike, I think what we're saying, though, in a way, is the first step is our local markets. The second step is our foreign markets. Isn't that what we're saying?
No, I think you're saying it the other way around. Or compatible, both developing at the same time.
I think they should both be there at the same time, but I'm terribly fearful of what would happen to a livestock industry if we don't have that link to a world market.
Yeah.
I'm afraid that you'll get this price swing that'll just be terribly radical.
Yeah, that's like you're saying.
And you're in trouble.
We've got to look at both. You people know that politically, we can't look at developing agriculture 100% on export. We see that in every meeting we go to. You know, what benefit are you going to be for Alaskans here in this state? We're looking at all the angles. Politically, we've got to have it. And Mike is saying economically, we've got to have that export base.
Well, the original report, just to add two things here. First of all, practically we can't look at it either, because not all barley or rapeseed you produce is going to be make grade to make the export market quality demands. Secondly, when we originally put the barley project proposal together, the price of the grain at farm gate was based on pool price. And pool price was based on about 20% of it being sold, 20 to 30% in the state, and the remainder on export. And I, just to add in parenthetically, I think the state should, in fact, come up with some kind of market development plan, that's another neat word for subsidy, to make sure that we can put in a port terminal, keep that thing operating until we get enough land into production to make that plant a viable plant economically, which says that if we say we're going to do that and put that facility in, we've got to get land into production as rapidly as we possibly can to get rid of that market development plan, which is the bulk of subsidy.
Okay, I think we've belabored that point for a while. Item 7, proposed food production training program for Interior Alaska. We'll get into that for a little bit. Kelly?
That's the Tanana Chiefs. Actually, it ties in with number 1, Pappy, Village Garden.
Okay, then we're going to propose to put 7 into it. I don't think we got enough copies for this right here. I'm sorry we didn't get it out, but it has to do with the food production program. I think the tag on that is probably, they're putting, if I remember right, $127,000 of their money into it. Isn't that it, Kelly?
There are several sources,
yeah.
I think the university.
They've got $127,500 they're putting in. That's a matching deal, but they need the figures, I think, is about better than half a million on monies that they need to continue on with their programs. Now, this is a gardening, small agribusiness projects that we're talking about in the Tanana Chiefs area.
Includes 27 villages, is it?
Okay. They're requesting $583,360 as a grant. Now, I would say this about these programs here, these small agro projects like this. This is just like the Selawik deal. We're developing an interest out in another area. Those people have some $900 million, 44 million acres. They're small project type operators. That help that we give them here would be to join with us on the large projects that we're trying to do. The more we've got in this thing of people, number wise, I think they're going to make it. So I'm suggesting that we put this in that garden projects, small agri projects bill that we've got up here on number 1. Kelly, have you got any other comments on that?
I don't.
Does anybody have any objection to adding it to that bill?
What's the dollar amount?
$583,000.
That's interesting.
Yeah, just about. I would say this, the tours that we made through these small projects, absolutely. I tell you, I don't mind admitting, last year I figured we were pouring some money down rat holes. But I thought maybe it's kind of like planting a few seed. If we don't plant them, we ain't going to get anything growing out of it. And I think this is the thing that will bring in another segment of our people in the state, throughout the state, all of these small projects that we're looking at. The whole concept is different right at this moment than what we have, for example, on the Delta project. But it's bringing more people, involving more people into the agribusiness overall. And that's why I'm asking for your support on this, and that we go through with these bills and grant the monies to these places that we're talking about, the Nenana and the Mentos and the Kuskokwim last year. We granted $150,000 down the lower end of Kuskokwim. We granted $400,000 to Koyukon. We granted $120,000 to start some of these programs last year to the Doyon Tananaw Chiefs area. I think that $600,000 to $700,000 that we put out is coming back. It's bread cast on the waters. And I think it's going to help our overall agricultural development throughout the state. Like I say, it involves more people. The more people we get involved in it, the better chance we've got to make it. So I'd ask you fellas if you have any objection that we add this to our bill.
The more votes you get for that magic number, Pat.
Huh? Yeah, it does spread it out a little more.
Good for you, Jack.
Any objection? Kelly, any comments?
Kelly doesn't have a vote.
I'm just wanting to make sure that I get my backup. She's my backup gal. She's my backup gal over there. So, then, the Tananaw Chiefs deal, we will put in the bill that we're working up on the other small agricultural development projects. We'll add it to it. Now, before we get into item 8, propose a bill to mandate agricultural land and rangeland classification. Have we got that bill together yet?
There you are, revising it.
I gave you a copy of it just now.
The rangeland deal? The
it's
draft?
It's back for revision again.
Is it?
We had to revise it, so shall we let that one ride until we get our revision back? Rangeland deal?
It does not specify, though, the rangeland use classification by the state of Alaska in the bill, even revised, or mandate any such classification.
The only thing I'd like to do is get some of that rangeland in state parks.
In the state parks or out of state parks?
In the state parks. I got one of them bills. I got some knots on my head about.
You know what they're calling you down in Delta?
I know, but
actually,
what I got in mind on that thing, maybe I better explain
my
and I ain't gonna put my foot in my mouth because I'll shut up when I figure I am. I got a sort of an ulterior motive on that thing because I'm hoping that we can get grazelands within these recreational areas. And if we can get the thing through that we'll also okay it for rangeland within parks where we got 1,000,000 acres, we can put a hell of a lot of grazing in. But I would bring up in the place of that.
Let's get the miners in there with the cows.
Well, hell yeah, we're going to backpack out. How many copies we got here? I might as well pass this out to some of you guys over here, too, so you can see what we're doing. This committee substitute for House Bill 274. This is one of our projects that... y'all want to stand up a minute, stretch your leg. My leg's kind of getting... I know we're kind of running a long time here. Take a look at this. This is committee substitute for House Bill 274, and what it does, basically, it establishes the Department of Agriculture with a commissioner. It's a rather lengthy bill, but I want to see, and I think some of the rest of us that have worked on this, I want to see a Department of Agriculture with a commissioner separating ag-related stuff from natural resources.
What's the fiscal note?
Well,
just off the top of your head.
This just came out of drafting today,
and
I asked for a fiscal note 3 weeks before this came out of drafting, and strangely enough, they haven't come up with one. I think they will within 5 days of seeing this, so that's their requirement, so I assume they'll meet it.
I think maybe this is going to cause a few sparks around, but the bill will be before the legislature before this session is out. And does everybody have a copy of it? Lee, you got a copy? I got an extra copy.
I can give a copy and get another one. Yeah.
Mike, would you like
you
to have one?
Take mine and I'll get one from Pappy.
You folks here, I think I'd appreciate, and I think the committee would, any comments you might have about what we're proposing here. But I think this is the answer to our problems in a lot of areas. I think this is the first time this bill has hit public, too. So we may get some... I should have given Bob one before he left a while ago.
Well, Pappy, maybe if we get a standing committee on transportation, we can solve some of these problems.
Well, I think that a Department of Agriculture is definitely a start. I think that I mentioned earlier that I don't think a lot of people realized how complex agriculture is, and that it's getting more complex every day. It isn't just for Alaska, it's all over. It's getting more important. And that our major problem in this state is a lack of coordination among all of the different agencies that are involved in agriculture. We've identified three major policy groups in agriculture and a minimum of six administrative groups. And that alone is causing us problems. Department of Agriculture is definitely the way to go.
Well, the major problem that we saw just initially looking at one of the duties charged to us by the Speaker of the House when the Agriculture Committee came into existence was to analyze closely the existing structure within the state and propose revisions which would make it more unified. And the main thing that we came across at the very start was that the agriculture is administered by the Department of Natural Resources, but the budget and funding is administered through another department, the Department of Commerce and Economic Development. So there's a very, very major schism at the very head of the industry.
Well, I personally think this Department of Agriculture is vital to us. We also have, if you'll note, I'll give my other copy away. In the back, we're even proposing something else that's a little innovative.
I have one more.
I gave my own.
Proposing a Board of Agriculture, similar to the Fish and Game Board, in relation to Fish and Game Department.
There's an error here. Line three. We originally had 13 members because we were including someone from the governor's office and another person from within the administration, but that figure should actually be 11 members on line three to tie in with one and two under subsection B there. Two members and nine members. And we removed the administration formally from the structure of the board because we felt that if we kept the administration on the board, then one element of the state administration would be administering to another element of the state administration, and we felt that that was not an orderly structure.
If you will note also, the Board of Agriculture, under the duties, a lot of the things we're talking about there falls under the ad hoc committees we've had in the past. It'll be the duty of the board to perform those duties. Now, the thing about this ad hoc committee is it can be, this whole thing has to be confirmed by the legislature just like the Fish and Game Board does. We will have more people involved from the various areas of the state where these things are coming about on this board. We'll have better input, I think, from the actual industry itself than we have under the ad hoc committees we have right now. I call it an ad hoc, the one that Bob Palmer's heading up right now. the biggest area that we've got right now trying to develop in agriculture, we don't even have a representative on that committee. I'm a little disappointed in it. Last year, whenever we had our free conference committee that set this thing up, I thought surely we'd have a person from the interior there that would have more input into the things that's been going on. This board here would actually have input from all over the state through the board members. Yeah, Jack?
That's what I'd like to ask you about, Mr. Chairman. As you know, all our boards usually leave out the Arctic and the northwestern section of our state. Geographically, I looked through your rapid. I didn't see anything as far as geographical location of your representation. Have you given that much thought?
Well,
I recognize everything is sort of concentrated in the interior area.
The intent was that there would be actually potentially two people could come from the far north, one to represent subsistence agriculture and one to represent the reindeer industry.
We're hoping that, also you'll notice there has to be a confirmation of the board members by the legislature. At that time, you had the opportunity to stand up and nominate your own man.
Well, we don't, sure as hell don't have that opportunity now, Pam.
I know you don't. This is where I'm coming from. And I think that enough of us are oriented now in the ag business in the legislature that that would give us the opportunity to nominate our own person. We don't necessarily, it says the governor will appoint it, but some of the basic changes on House Bill 275 is going to be the this $5,600,000 will be a change that we'll propose. Line 10, the figure will be changed to $5,600,000. We will delete Section 2, amend Section 3 so that it takes effect immediately upon passage. Beers also, and one for you should have one in your packet over there.
We
scratched
it all up.
New section, immediate effective date clause. Isn't that the way it read, Pepe?
Okay, the changes on. Okay, now this committee substitute House Bill 275 in the legislature state of Alaska, first session is the bill that we're looking at here. Now that was committee substituted by resource. Across why we need it.